go.
I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Education for February 2nd, 2015. We welcome you all here. It's going to be an exciting year when we in education, but what I want to do first is just talk a little bit about the committee. Committee members, on your desk, you have a few things of interest, and we'll be discussing the House Committee rules in just a minute, but those of you not into education yet, we have a list of all the educational terms and acronyms.
All of them?
Well, two pages of them. And they're both state and federal, but so when we start talking in letters instead of full words, you'll know that. And then the other thing just I thought would be of help is just a memo on kind of committee membership recommendations. It's everything about, you know, when we start and you know, if you have a question during the hearing, all that kind of thing. So those are just on your desk for information. So before we get to anything official, I'd like you guys to introduce yourselves first, if you want to start down with Representative Barreto.
Representative Greg Barreto, I am from District 58, Wallowa County, Union County, and then part of Umatilla County. So.
Okay. Carla Peluso, Representative House of District 50, Gresham.
Jody Hack, Representative House District 19, which is South Salem, Almsville, and Turner.
Lou Frederick, I'm House District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland, Lloyd Center, Concordia University, and PCC Cascade.
Okay, we'll do that and I'll end up. Susan?
I'm from Western Washington County, and my name is Susan McLean, and I just finished 42 years of teaching.
Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass.
I'm Jeff Reardon, State Rep, District 48, Outer Southeast Portland, Happy Valley. Former business person, school board member, and teacher.
Got it all.
Sherry Springer, State Rep from House District 17. That's the eastern parts of Linn and Marion County, like Waterloo, Sweet Home, Lebanon, Scio, Staten, Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana, all of which are incorporated cities. And I have five school districts in my area.
Okay, excellent. And I'm Margaret Doherty, the chair, and I represent Tigard in Southwest Portland. And a little thing of note is that Representative McLean and I, when we were much younger, used to debate against each other in college. I was at Portland State. She was at OCE. Mm-hmm. She was very good. And then also, if you want to introduce yourself also.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Richard Donovan, and I'm going to be acting as your committee administrator this session.
Okay, great. The first order of business we have is to adopt our committee house rules. And we do have a couple of differences from this year to last year. And so, pardon? Okay. And so we're going to be talking about that after we open an organizational session, work session. And so the first thing dealing with committee house rules, committee rules.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The rules, the house rule, the committee rules are basically unchanged from last session with two important exceptions. One is that the process for filing a notice of intent for minority report has changed a little bit. It was until 5 p.m. The current rule is now a two-hour notice time, so tell committee staff, myself, of any notice of intent. You can say it here in the room or just email it. And the other point that's of interest is that all amendments that the committee is going to work have to be posted online on the legislature's oldest system for 1 hour before the committee can do any work on them. They can be discussed, they can be heard, but they cannot be worked or adopted.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Sprague?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, 2 hours from adjournment of that committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, yes, that's correct. 2 hours from adjournment of the committee. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions about the committee rules? Okay, with that, do we need to adopt them? If could I have a motion to adopt
Chair
the committee?
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, I guess we just vote on it. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. House committee rules are adopted. The motion passes. The one thing with the kind of the differences in this committee, because a lot of you are new to the legislature, some of you not so new to education, was to kind of have an education 101 in the state of Oregon. And so we're going to have, an informational meeting, and we're going to open the informational hearing in just a moment. But the purpose of this was to kind of give you a background as to the who, what, why, where of Oregon 101. So I would like to open an informational hearing on the educational agencies in Oregon. And so I don't know how you guys want to do it. The invited speakers we have, starting out with Nancy Golden, who is the Chief Education Officer of the OEIB. We have Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for ODE. Ben Cannon, Executive Director of HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Committee. Meg Irwin, we'll be hearing from later, is the Acting Early Learning Systems Director for the Early Learning Systems, and then Iris Bell, who's the Executive Director of Youth Development Council. So, of course, like everything, make sure you introduce yourselves for the record, and then we'll hear from them, and then if you have any questions, please feel free. We'll ask at the end. So,
thank you. So, Chair, Madam Doherty, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden. I'm the Chief Education Officer, and I'm here today presenting on behalf of the OEIB. I want to recognize Chairperson Doherty, your commitment to education and the years you've spent. And even before I knew you, you were known as a person with great passion for students.
Well, thank you.
So congratulations on being the chairperson. I also want to thank you for the invitation to be here and talk a little bit about the OEIB, the seamless system we're putting together, and the partners who are working together to achieve that. So I want to talk about who you'll be hearing from today. You'll be hearing from the Acting Early Learning Director, Megan Irwin. You'll be hearing from the Deputy Superintendent, Rob Saxton, the Youth Development Director, Iris Bell, and Ben Cannon, the Executive Director of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. What we're here to provide is an overview of a seamless education system that I oversee as the Chief Education Officer. I'm going to be talking to you about the work of the Oregon Education Investment Board, which was charged by the legislators to provide a strategic leadership and coordination in the public education system. After I talk a bit, each of the directors will be talking about their role in leading and managing their particular section of the seamless system. This is my job. So I want to begin by talking about the opportunity for every Oregonian to reach their potential. And I want to begin by a story that occurred when I was superintendent in the Springfield School District. And I was walking down the hall, and there was this precious little guy. And he looked to be a kindergartner or first grader. And when you don't have a key around your neck which says, I'm going to the bathroom, as an adult, you kind of stop and make sure they're going where they're supposed to be. So when I leaned down and asked this little guy, where are you going? He said, I'm going to college. And that's our job, to get them there. And honestly, that's mostly what the Oregon Education Investment Board is. It's creating a seamless system of education where what we really do is have a unique role of looking at it from the child's perspective and how, based on birth, through college and career, can we really get that child to move seamlessly along the pathway? Or if they've fallen off the pathway, which some of our students do, how do we provide the supports to get them back on the pathway? So that's pretty much the core job. And here's the goal. By 2025, 40% of adult Oregonians will hold a bachelor's or advanced degree, 40% will have an associate's degree or a meaningful post-secondary certificate, and all Oregonians will graduate from high school. So this is sort of the directive of the OEIB, is to work towards meeting those goals. It was approved by a bipartisan supermajority by both chambers and the legislature. So that is our guiding North Star, as you say. Now, I want to go back to that little guy, and I want to tell you part of the reasons why that little boy responded that way is he was in a school that was creating a college-going culture. Since we've set up this goal, there's many schools that are doing that. That was called a No Excuses University, where they start in kindergarten helping kids see that if you work hard, you can get to college and that everyone can do that. There's also the Dreamer School. You've probably heard about that. That's Alder and Reynolds. And we have College Possible. Well, I think it's great that we're creating these college-going cultures in elementary, but I feel a tremendous responsibility then to make sure the system is aligned so we truly can get the students there. So we take that very seriously, the goal. Then I want to talk a little bit about how OEIB coordinates the system. So OEIB, before OEIB, there was no statewide strategy to make sure we didn't work in silos. In fact, we were laser focused on transition so students could move seamlessly. Let's look at this again from a child's point of view. What we all know is every child doesn't come to kindergarten at the same part of the starting line. Some children have been read to every single night, maybe 4 books, 5 books. Other children don't even have a book in their home. And so when they come to school in kindergarten, they're not at the same point. That's why starting in early learning is so critical, starting at birth to age 5, to make sure everyone comes to kindergarten ready to learn. So that's one way that we overcome persistent barriers. And then there's also a growing student opportunity gap. One of the things the research says, which is so powerful, is that some students hear over 30 million more words than other students by age 3. Now, that's words are repeated. It doesn't mean separate words, of course. Mm-hmm. But you know that vocabulary is a key literacy skill in order to get all students, I'm looking at the teachers here, all students to be successful along the pathway. So there is a gap, and we really need to have a system starting early so we can overcome that gap. What we also know is that before, we kind of worked in silos, not intentionally, but there was early learning, there was K-12, there was community college, and there was higher ed. And the job of the OEIB to make sure we work in a seamless system. One powerful experience I had that drives this one home is, again, when I was superintendent, we started talking about the 40-40-20 goal, and I've been involved in this for a long time, and I believe in it deeply. I thought I better go down into Head Start. I've never been to the Head Start programs in my own district. I'm embarrassed to tell you that. And when I went to the Head Start program, this woman was showing me around, and I assumed she was the principal. And she went and showed me a portfolio for these are three-year-olds, portfolios about the standards and how they were demonstrating meeting the standards. And I thought we should have portfolios for our kindergartners. Then she showed me how they actually, the whole set of standards, and then she went in and showed me how they train teachers, how they just-in-time train teachers. It wasn't until 2 hours later when a new person entered, I said, well, who are you? And she said, I'm the principal. So then I turned to this other person and said, I'm sorry, I should have asked what your role is. She said, I'm a parent who has students in this program. And I thought, I have never used parents as powerfully in kindergarten as I saw being used in early learning. And just that idea of age 3 to grade 3 and having common standards and really learning from each other, the power of what we each do along the pathway really does start removing barriers. You know, I think about that parent who was so empowered. If they came into a kindergarten class where there wasn't the same level of empowerment, they might take a message that we didn't care as much, which certainly wasn't the message, or we didn't believe in parent empowerment. So overcoming these silos is absolutely critical. So what was the OEIB created to do. It was created to achieve the 40-40-20 goal by 2025 to lead and coordinate a seamless system of education from birth through college and career. It was developed to develop statewide student learning outcomes. It was to develop strategies to achieve the outcomes, and particularly the focus on these key transitions. So I talked about from age 3 to grade 3. And the other key transition is what we call 11 through 14, high school through college. What can we do in high school to really leverage our students to be successful in college? We also make recommendations around strategic investments to the governor's budget, which now which goes on to the legislators. So what's really important about all of this, I think, with the seamless system is how all of these stages leverage the other. So if we have stable and attached families, then we know we can have kids ready for kindergarten. If kids come to kindergarten ready, then they can be reading proficiently by third grade. If kids are reading proficiently by third grade, just think four times as many kids drop out of school if they're not reading proficiently by third grade. We don't want dropouts, we want graduates. So if we get them reading proficiently by third grade, then there's a much greater chance that they're gonna complete high school, and after that they can seamlessly go on and get certificates or post-secondary education. I want to talk about this a little bit. I'm just going to focus on the leverage points again to give an example. Reading proficiently by third grade. What the research says, if a child doesn't read proficiently by third grade, they're after age 9, 85 to 90% of them will have difficulties in reading all along the pathway. So if we don't get them early, what that means is, what I think of as a superintendent, is how much money we put into remediation after age 3. Resource rooms, special classrooms, computer instruction. And I think about, if we didn't have to pay for that remediation, first of all, think of the self-concept of the child, and that's what worries me the most. But think of how much music we could have, how many arts we could have, how many electives that we lost, and how we could even lower class size if we weren't spending money on remediation. So as you can see, these leverage each other in a very proactive way that I think ultimately it will free up some resources to use proactively as opposed to using reactively. So this is the new organizational chart, and what you're not seeing is the old chart, but I'm here to tell you it's much less complex than the old chart. And really? What we know is that what's critical to this chart is that that there's a single point of leadership that is with me to work side by side with my colleagues along the pathway to make sure we're partners with the educational entities to really work to make sure we can get kids to move seamlessly along the pathway. It's really about reframing our work, OAIB. We think of policy, we think of improvement, and we think of investment to create a P20 or birth through college and career. Mm-hmm. We recognize the role that OAIB has to be nimble. It has to be a strategy setting board. It is not a super board overburdened with micromanagement of the entire system. The authority to govern is really with each of the sections. That is not what OAIB is about. OAIB is about the things I've described to you before: creating a seamless system, managing the transitions, thinking about policy and strategic investments. And it's my job as a chief education officer to work with the small but mighty team we have to ensure that we have the seamlessness. So here is sort of the organizational chart that describes that, and you can see how all of us work in relationship to each other. The next thing I want to talk about are the achievement compacts, which is core to the work of the OEIB. So there's achievement compacts that have key outcomes that students want to achieve. Well, you remember the little guy, right, that I introduced earlier. And I want to talk to you about, let's make believe you're this little guy hitting all the targets on the achievement compact. So if he's ready for kindergarten, he's going to think, I'm ready. If he's reading proficiently at third grade, he'll say, I'm reading, and now I can read to learn. At fifth and eighth grade proficiency, he would say, Algebra 2 is not a barrier for me, and that's the reason a lot of students drop out. In sixth and ninth grade, if we eliminate chronic absenteeism, which is another outcome, he would say, I can read, I can do math, I love to go to school, and I'm going to be 100% attender. Ninth grade on track, which means that students have 6 high school credits and 90% attendance, that student's going to say, I'm on track to graduate. And 3 college credits, which is the next outcome, the student is going to say, I've tasted college, I love it, I'm going to college. Now, if college is affordable, and of course it can be affordable, if we can start getting college courses in high school, then students begin to think, I've gotten some courses in high school, I've got a scholarship, I can afford it, I'm going. And if we focus on completion, this child's going to say, I did it. I'm a college graduate. I've done my job. I can buy a house now that I have a job. I can stimulate the economy, and we're all going to prosper. So what the achievement compacts really are about are all those outcomes, ready for kindergarten, reading at third grade, elimination of chronic absenteeism, strong math skills, on track in ninth grade, 3 college credits in high school, and accessible and affordable post-secondary experience. So as you can see, the achievement compacts is a core piece of the work that we do. Now another piece, we have a very small group, but we do research, and with our strategic investments, we do research. We have a small group of 3 people who do research to really make sure our policies are making a difference. And I want to just give you an early out example. This data just came in. Eastern Promise is the idea of it. It started in East of the Mountains of how do we really get college credit in high school. In 2013, 2014, there were 30,000 college credits given to students in that region. The students who took a college course in high school, which is called Credit by Proficiency course, 80% of them went to college as opposed to before 54% of them, because they got to experience it. They got to see what it was like. They got support around doing it. And if we look at students in poverty, 72% went to college versus 45%. Now, sometimes we talk about return on investment. For the parents, they saved $1.7 million by getting college credits in high school. This makes it so some families can now say, I can afford to have my child go on to college because I got some of that done in high school. And what the work has said is that 7% of the students who've had some of the experience in high school, 7% probably will have an 7% more will have an opportunity to complete college because of that 11 through 14 transition that we've been working on. Another really important part of the OEIB is community engagement. When we started thinking about early reading, which starts at birth, but when we really focused on age 3 to grade 3, we went out to our communities, we talked to them, we talked to them about if there's a reading campaign, what would it look like, how would it work for you, And some of our parents said, it just has to be easy. I'm not a teacher. I don't know how to teach. But if you can tell me things I can do, and what they learned is if you talk to your children, if you sing to your children, if you play with your children, if you story tell, you're building those vocabularies. That's the 30 million more words. And parents were saying, I can do that. But it was our communities who told us how they wanted the campaign to go. And so then when we launched the campaign, it was very successful because of that. Another example is the strategic investments we're suggesting in age 3 to grade 3. We developed those as a result of bringing together a diverse group of people. So what we said is the faces of the leaders in the room need to reflect the faces of the children in our state. And they need to be people who have demonstrated success in early learning. And so the recommendations that came up came specifically from this wide, diverse stakeholder group. So we make sure we engage the community. We think our recommendations will be so much stronger as a result of doing that. One we're very focused on now is chronic absenteeism. I know that's a concern to all of us in this state. We know as teachers, if we can't get them there, it's very hard to teach them. So OEIB is now doing what we call our cycle, which is we're going out to the community, we're reviewing the research, we're finding what the best practices are, and we're going out to our communities to engage with them about how are we together going to overcome the issue of chronic absenteeism. So it's a collective impact, wrap our arms around the communities, work side by side with them to make a difference. The other thing, and this I think was one of the things I was most proud of with the Oregon Education Investment Board, was the adoption of the equity lens. And when we adopted the equity lens, what it allowed us to do is highlight, and it was a call to action to resolve the disparities that we have in our student populations. We have students in the opportunity gap, and we need to understand what those students need in order to be successful in school. And every strategic investment we came up with, we looked at through the equity lens. We also said, how can we close the opportunity gap? And I think you've seen examples of this many places, but Douglas Gardens working with the Children's Institute, they have preschools in their a preschool in one of their schools. They're working with housing, they're working with diverse programs, culturally specific programs like NAIA, like SEI, Self Enhancement Inc. They're making sure that students can see their cultures in their schools. When I go to school, there's books on the shelves that reflect my culture, that reflects all the cultures. Holidays are celebrated that reflects all of the holidays. And they're making sure that they bring best practices to everything they do. We also are addressing poverty, which is another really big equity issue, and we're working with our hubs and our CCOs to do that. This is just really about how do we improve our system's capacity to deliver, and one thing is standards. Remember I talked about standards for those little guys? Well, we need to make sure we have standards that are articulated across the system. For us, the standards are the Common Core state standards in K-12, and then we're extending those into higher ed, and we're working to make sure we have those in early learning. We're working on an effective assessment system. And remember when I talked about convening? One of the convenings I'm most excited about is the convening we've been doing with groups of people, with teachers around the state, with OEIB, with COSA, with ODE, with OEA, to really look at over-testing and how do we really work on that so that we do use the power of testing, the power of formative assessment that informs instruction, the power of interim assessment that makes you think about what extra do kids need or do they need to accelerate. How do we balance that with summative assessment? Pretty soon we'll be having recommendations come out about that. And then there's our longitudinal database. And the longitudinal database allows us to measure success, determine future investments, and to make data easily accessible. We also know that it's important that we have quality teachers, that our teachers get staff development, that there's a network of educators who help provide professional development to each other, and that our teaching workforce is diverse, that it truly reflects the faces of our children, and so we really work hard on that, and we've had some strategic investments in that. And there's things we have to study about all of these issues. For example, in the issue of hiring diverse workforce, we know that there's about 1,000 people who are from diverse cultures who hold certificates but haven't been hired. Why is that? We need to find out why that is, and we need to really then know what we work on. So my very last slide is just about talking about there's basically three pathways: the pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading, the pathway to high school and post-secondary completion, and the pathway for connecting education to careers. I've talked a little bit about the third grade reading, but I want to talk just a little bit more about that. The goal is that 95% of our students will be reading proficiently by third grade. And we know to do that, we need full-day kindergarten, we need research-based reading programs, we need partnerships with community organizations, specifically culturally specific organizations, and we need high-quality teachers and high-quality leaders. The pathway to high school and post-secondary, it really requires that we really work to accelerate learning in high school, like I've talked about, like I talked about with Eastern Promise, that college is affordable, that we have completion. And what we also know is there's key leverage points. For our English language learners, we need to make sure they're proficient by eighth grade and they can move out of English language learning programs and move into their high schools with the skills to just move forward. We need to make sure there's sufficient credit attainment and attendance in ninth grade, and we need to make sure those college courses are given with accelerated learning. We also know that educators need training to be culturally responsive, to see them, to work to make their classroom the places every child feels valued. And then, I'll leave that up to someone smarter than me at this moment.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ben Cannon, I'm the Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and I think this rather awkward and confusing slide is the point, is my cue to do a slightly deeper dive, although I promise it won't be more than just a couple of minutes, on some of the recent changes to how higher education is governed from the state standpoint, and of course how that fits into the Oregon Education Investment Board and its broader P20 responsibilities. So this animated slide, if you're looking at a printout, you won't see the animation, but I'll put it up on the chart now, attempts to reflect or depict on the left-hand side how higher education was organized in the state prior to 2013, and on the right-hand side, the changes that are really wrapping up this year to take full effect on July 1st, 2015. And what you'll see is a significant consolidation of state agencies and boards and commissions, while you'll also see a pushing down of authority to the institutional level. And we expect the pushing down of resources, too, to the institutional level to support their important role in teaching and learning. So I'll reach. So this, I'm going to go fairly quickly. On the left-hand side now, the blue bars here represent governing boards, and the pink or orange salmon, let's call it salmon, colored boxes are institutions of higher education, specifically the 7 public universities and the 17 community colleges. And as you can see, prior to 2013, we had 17 locally governed community colleges and 7 public universities overseen by a single state board and an office of the chancellor known as the Oregon University System. Meanwhile, there were 4 other boards at the state, all also in the business of helping support and create rules for the road and funding allocations for higher education in Oregon. And those included the Office of Student Access and the Oregon Student Access Commission, it's been renamed, the State Board of Ed, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and the OEIB. So as a result of work that many of you
and those are all on our little sheet of acronyms.
Very good. We couldn't fit them all here. I'm glad you have that cheat sheet. As a result of legislation that many of you were involved in adopting, this world has changed. And so what didn't change on the right-hand side was the fact that we continue to have 17 community colleges and 7 public universities, but the governance of those institutions did. And so let me just back up before we get to the state. So you'll notice here that what we did initially was spin out new institutional boards for our 3 largest public universities, PSU, OSU, and University of Oregon. We maintained the OEIB, but we beneath it created a single supporting board, the HEC, that combines the functions that were previously held for higher education by the Oregon Student Access Commission, the State Board of Education, the State Board of Higher Education. We created a shared services entity to help support the universities. We created a single agency under the HEC with offices, and the OEIB adopts achievement compacts that reflect the relationship between the state bodies on the top and the institutional entities at the bottom. The final step, effective this July, later this year, will be the completion of the reorganization with 4 additional university boards that will govern the 4 smaller regional and technical universities. Those boards have been appointed and confirmed and will take their full authority in July of this year. So significant changes that have taken place since 2013. You see community colleges, universities, and state financial aid in a single agency with a single board, the HEC, working with the OEIB on the delivery of those services and oversight of those responsibilities. You see grades 10 to 14 or 11 through 14 connected through the higher ed coordinating commission and the OEIB with OEIB staff particularly attentive to those connecting those silos. You see the streamlining clarity where we've moved from 4 state boards to 1, although to be clear, also the creation of new boards at the institutional level, but at the state level going from 4 to 1 plus the OEIB in its full P20 oversight, clarified roles, a single post-secondary agency, and freeing up resources for teaching and learning at the institutional level. And all of this, I think the proof will be in the pudding, but part of the rationale is the very significant challenges that we have in higher education having to do with resources, but having also to do with the success of students who, many of whom enroll but don't complete, better connecting with K-12 through the initiatives that Nancy described, tackling affordability to ensure that we're lowering that barrier, putting more resources and permitting institutions to put more resources into coaching, mentoring, student success efforts that are so critical for improving outcomes really is reflected in this streamlined organization that tries to push resources to the local level. So I think that's where I will.
Because I turned the slide, it cued the bend to go forward, but I didn't finish the third pathway, and I want to make sure because it's critical. It's the pathway connecting education to careers, and that's really about the CTE STEM work that we've been doing. What we know is many kids learn best if it's taught in a way that it's very hands-on, it's very related to careers. You hear the theory, and you get to apply them right away, and for us, that's what CTE is, along with STEM. We know there's so many jobs in this area, from the health science, medical jobs, to high-tech manufacturing, to computer science. So we're really working very hard to make sure we have CTE STEM careers that will, and we're really working with industry to know where the jobs are, but build those strong foundational skills along the way. So I didn't want to leave the those out because it's critical to our pathway, and I know how important it is to Representative Reardon to everyone, but just to make sure our students can move right into the world of work, get great jobs, and can move forward with their lives.
Okay. Well, I think before we moved on to the Oregon Department of Education, do you have any questions about OEIB? All of the information is on OLIS. Good explanation. I just didn't know that much myself, so it was very informative. Representative Brown.
Yeah, I met with the school board in LeGrand last week, and then over in Grant County, Dan and John Day, Ted Ferrioli, myself, Cliff Bence, and then John Huffman also met with the superintendents and ESD, actually from all of Eastern Oregon. And they, you know, the OEIB, you know, they were not too sold on, you know. And matter of fact, they said, you know, it they really don't quite know who to follow. And, of course, I think there's a lot of upheaval in education right now. And with the reports last week that, you know, we're graduating 68%, I think how much feedback, you know, are you getting from the superintendents and from the educational service districts, you know, as far as how this is working and just input that they have, because they're right down in the trenches on this.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm fairly new to it, you know, so I'm just kind of hearing this stuff and kind of working it through. So
Sherry Doherty, Representative Barreto.
Barreto,
thank you. Well, I spent the last 2 days with the superintendents. I'm very connected to them. We go to all their policy and vision committees, and I think what is going on for superintendents is this balance between feeling like, you know, it's a new notion. When you look at our graduation rate, what we believe is that you know, things are not top down or bottom up. There's a combination. As a state, you've got to be strategic, and you need to focus on certain key targets, which are achievement compacts, to move our state along. And that's a new notion for superintendents. I mean, they're very used to getting resources and being able to decide specifically how to use it. When I talk about the outcomes on the pathway, I don't think any of them disagree with those outcomes, ready for kindergarten, reading by third grade. But then when you start talking about really sort of in a coordinated way, getting strategic, it's just a whole new and different thing. So we continue to talk about that, you know, and we heard from Mark Witte. I heard from him this morning, the superintendent, and John Day. I've been over there and met with that community. It's a delightful community, and they're just trying to really figure out, this is a whole new big idea, so how does it all work together? And you know how people say things get, it takes a while for things to get really, they get kind of, at first it's hard to understand, it takes a while before the system really becomes clear to everyone. So it's a really new approach to a P20 system. But again, we had a great presenter from Montgomery County School District. He's gotten results around graduation, particularly graduation of students of color, but all students. And what he says is, I owe that to early learning. And without early learning, it would be impossible to get these results. But it's hard for people in different silos to see how a P20 system can benefit overall kids, because it's going to take a while to put the system in place. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you. Representative McLean, then Representative Wilson.
Well, can you put up that the graphic which was showing the new and the old as far as the structure? I was just curious and interested in the fact that when you were switching from before 2013 to post-2013, that you were consolidating on the top, and then you added more boxes on the bottom. And you've talked throughout this presentation about the importance, you know, of coordination. Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the challenges that you see ahead of you as far as having separate boards for the higher education elements of the system? Mm-hmm. And what are some of the advantages that you're hopefully starting to see?
Representative McLean, Chair Doherty, I'll give a brief answer that will do only partial justice to a really good question. You're astute in your observation. We did consolidate at the state. Meanwhile, we created more boards and greater levels of institutional autonomy at the local level, and I think that put higher education in a similar position to where K-12 has been, 190 whatever separately governed local school districts, and that does create challenges. At the same time, the authorities that the state has maintained and the responsibility that the state has maintained, of course through the legislature and also through a single commission, the HAC, and single agency for convening institutions to develop common pathways, common standards, articulation agreements. The funding allocation responsibility that of course you have from the standpoint of appropriating dollars and then the HEC retains to allocate those dollars to institutions becomes a very important mechanism for helping bring them together around greater levels of collaboration. The program approval authority that the state has maintained through the HAC, if an institution, a public university or community college, wants to start a new program, they come to the state for approval, becomes another mechanism we can use to help drive collaboration, looking for and improving programs, partly on the basis of the extent to which they've collaborated with each other. And finally, the regulatory oversight that we've maintained around the private institutions, for-profits, trade schools, other degree-granting private institutions, gives us another mechanism for helping to convene and consider their contributions to this larger enterprise, as well as maintaining the consumer protection kinds of safeguards, but I think can also drive towards collaboration. You're absolutely right. There's no doubt it's a challenge. I think it's an uncertain future in terms of whether it will result ultimately in much greater levels of coordination and collaboration, which, of course, is in our title as the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. But it remains to be seen. Final point, I think there is significant value in creating these boards that are really locally. I mean, we see this in K-12 too, that the power of sort of local ownership and responsibility, the engagement of these volunteer members of boards, now boards of trustees of universities, who know those communities, know those students, know those institutions in a way that the State Board of Higher Ed struggled to do, frankly, has itself, I think, a significant benefit. Challenges maybe on the collaboration front, we'll see, but certainly a significant benefit in terms of really building local institutional buy-in.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Doherty. To Ms. Golden, I would think that the job that you have would be extremely stimulating given the challenges. You know, I am a news person and I read stories all the time about our dropout rate and absentee rate, which seem to be pretty devastating at this point. But I do want to say that I'm extremely interested in a number of these ideas that you bring up. The third grade reading proficiency, I really believe I agree with that. I think that is really time well spent, and I look forward to continuing that conversation as we go. But again, it seems like you have a tremendous job ahead of you, given the challenges that we face in this day and age. I was thinking that one thing that might make coming to work even more interesting is a bill that I have about repealing Common Core. And I hear a lot about that from parents constantly. Some don't exactly know what they're talking about, and some of them really do know what they're talking about. But it would seem to me, to add to the panoply of things that you're dealing with, if you had an opportunity to develop our own exclusive Oregon State standards instead of federal standards, it might be even more interesting for you. Just a thought.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Thank you.
I think we can. Any other questions? We've got about another hour and 10. We want to make sure that we have everybody have enough time. So we will move on to Mr. Saxton of the Department of Education. And then also Ms. Bell and Ms. Irwin. You're in the middle, Rob.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. We're going to start with early learning since it's the beginning of the continuum. We're part of the Department of Education. Then we'll move to Rob, and then we'll move to Iris. So that's how we organized our time today.
Thank you.
So for the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you briefly today about the work that we're doing at the Early Learning Division. Today I'm really just going to do two things by way of orientation. I'll give you an overview of the Early Learning Division's structure and the work that we're responsible for, and I'll share some high-level information with you on some of the strategic initiatives that we've been driving toward over the last 2 years. While the work to reshape the state's early learning system began back in 2011, and those of you who have served in the legislature for a while have been hearing about it since then, the Early Learning Division has actually only existed as an implementation body for that work since July 2013, when we were established as a division that's part of the Department of Education. And this here is our mission. By statute, the Early Learning Division is charged with ensuring that children enter kindergarten prepared to succeed in school. And from that charge, we've extrapolated with our governing body, the Early Learning Council, three high-level goals. These are also in statute that we're responsible for in all of our work. You can see them here on the slide. You saw them reflected in the slides that Nancy showed you as well. And they all point us toward third grade reading and achieving 40-40-20. All of our work as a division flows back to these three goals, and I have to say that we really wouldn't have this clear of a focus strategically or organizationally if it wasn't for the creation of the Early Learning Council, the commitment of this legislative body in helping us have such clear goals, and the support from OEIB on managing the key transitions. So in Nancy's presentation, you heard her talk a little bit about some of the silos that we've been trying to overcome as a P20 system. This slide shows you the silos that existed previously just in the early learning, the birth through five part of the system. And I think that it really shows why the work that this body did over the last 4 years to streamline and differently organize our early learning system was so important. Prior to 2013, when we were created as a division, the state's early learning programs were administered by a variety of state and local government agencies, governed by a variety of commissions and boards, to the extent that even just coordinating across agencies was very challenging. Trying to make sense of this system of supports as a family was impossible. So, thanks to a series of really important pieces of legislation passed in 2011, 2012, and 2013, the picture looks really different today. From the governance perspective, we've consolidated four of those former commissions and councils mentioned on the previous slide into one early learning council, which is charged for administering and overseeing the early learning work for the state overall. And then from an agency perspective, we consolidated the functions and programs from three state agencies into one division, which is now inside the Department of Education, where our focus can really be on early learning and development and education. And then in terms of the local work, we've moved from 36 county commissions on children and families to 16 early learning hubs, which are coordinating their work across a variety of local service providers. I'll touch on that in a little bit more depth later. But I think that this just shows the strategic direction we've gone to try to streamline our services so that we can build a system that makes more sense at the state level so that it can make more sense for families on the ground. So inside the division, just to give you a quick overview, we have specific responsibility for several core functions, and this is how we organize our work. It's on the slide. It's in your packets. I won't read it to you. I did want to call attention to the last bullet here because it's part of our work that I think a lot of folks don't actually naturally realize. The Early Learning Division is responsible for regulating, licensing, and monitoring child care, and that is a big part of what we do. It's most of my staff. Most children in our state who are under age five are in child care. It's a critically important part of our early learning system, and it's a part that often goes unseen. As part of that regulatory arm, we license child care providers, we train them and provide basic safety training like first aid and CPR. We also monitor them to make sure that they're staying in compliance with those rules across the state. We have 9 field offices. And then finally, we're really working with our licensed providers to build the quality of their programs so that we're building childcare settings where, again, most children are, in a way where early learning and development is happening on purpose. And I just wanted to highlight that for you because I think it's a nuance that this committee may not be familiar with. This just shows you a quick glimpse of the core early learning services and programs that we administer in addition to childcare. We will go into all of these programs in a lot of depth during the Ways and Means process, so this is just here today for your information to see some of the core things that we're responsible for. So I think probably the piece of work that's gotten the most attention around the early learning system for the last couple of years are some of the system change efforts that we've been working to implement. And each one of these here on the slide are absolutely critical to our work. The early learning hubs are changing the way that services reach families locally and the way that we're able to actually invest and best leverage limited resources for early childhood education. Our work to align age 3 to grade 3, again, Nancy hit on all of the reasons why it's critically important. Rob will talk about it a bit in his presentation as well. But I think that this new focus on connecting early childhood education to the formal public education system is critically important for us to reach our goals around third grade reading. And then finally, this focus that we have at the Early Learning Division on equity, which truly would not have come about in the way that it has without the OEIB's equity lens that they've adopted. And we're really excited to be focusing on that work and looking at which students or which future students across our state are experiencing the most disparities in early childhood so that we can work to close those opportunity gaps earlier. Mm-hmm. Of those three big strategic initiatives we've been focusing on, today I'm just going to do a flyover on the hubs because I think it's the one that's the least understood and probably that you've heard the most about and that Rob won't be talking about later in his presentation. So early learning hubs were designed to work as local coordinators for early learning services, and they're really tasked with working with us at the state level to build a more coherent, more cohesive early learning system out of what's traditionally been, again, a patchwork of programs and services at the state level and similarly a patchwork at the local level. They were created to make sure that resources and supports are more available, more accessible, and more effective for children and families that are historically overrepresented in our opportunity gap once they get to formal school and underrepresented in accessing local services. And you can see here the simplest level what the hubs are tasked with doing: identifying populations of children who are most at risk of being unprepared for school, identifying their needs, working across health, human services, early childhood, the private sector, and K-12 to connect children and families to services that will meet their needs, and then accounting for outcomes collectively. And the outcomes that the hubs are responsible for are identical to the ones that we're responsible for at the early learning division to create that connection in our state to local system. This is where they are. Over the last year, 14 hubs have been developed locally across the state, with the final two to come to contract by June. The two that are not yet at contract with us are in Salmon here. We're doing a ton of work with these communities to provide them the support they need to be ready to get there. I have to say that the way that communities around our state have come together with a really clear and focused set of goals and started to make targeted investments is remarkable. Last week, I had the chance to spend several hours in person with the leadership of Early Learning Hub, Inc., which covers Marion and Polk County. And there was a superintendent in the room who said, we can't do it alone, get kids ready for school. We can't do it without leveraging resources from each other, and we can't do it without our early learning hub. And it was really wonderful to start to see those connections being made across sectors in a way that I deeply believe is best for children and families. There's an extremely detailed report that's going to come out to all of you on Wednesday, giving an overview of the way that the hub system has developed and our recommendations for the future. So I'll be happy to come back and do a deeper dive into early learning hubs if you're interested at any point. But I did want to point out before I passed to Rob that I think one of the areas where we're seeing the most traction as a result of the hubs is in this connection between early childhood and the K-3 system. And I think that's in part thanks to the hubs, in part thanks to a kindergarten partnership and innovation grant that the legislature funded last year. And it's provided us with some really fascinating data on what can happen for kids if you make that connection more seamless. And I'm going to pass it off to my colleague Rob to talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you. Mr. Saxton?
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. Very pleased to be here today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Oregon Department of Education. It'll be a really high-level overview. I'd be happy to come back as many times as you'd like to have me and or meet with each of you individually at any point in time. If you have questions, please contact me and folks at the department, and we'll do everything we can to support. It's great to be here today. Just want to tell you what a pleasure it is to work with my colleagues, Ben, Nancy, Iris, and Megan, and just what a great team, how fun it is to, as Representative Wilson talked about, having some energy as we come into work every day, and it's very, very true. So Department of Education, and I'm just going to point at these, and maybe you can do that. Thank you, Megan. I want to talk just a little bit about our mission statement. So this is an important component for us, our mission statement. And this is new in 2012. We still have our same mission statement since then and anticipate that we'll be keeping it for some time. And part of the thing that I really like about this is where it says the Oregon Department of Education fosters excellence for every learner. And the part about fostering excellence for every learner is the part that I think that is a keen focus for us at the department. And it is that the work that we do really needs to reach out into schools and make a difference for kids who attend schools in our state every day. And that is what our work is about, and doing that well is extremely important to us and therefore is part of our mission. We adopted a strategic plan also in 2012, and it has targets that take us through this June, really to July or June 30 of 2015. And then as we move through this session and work with the Oregon Education Investment Board, we'll be putting in our new strategic plan. And it has five components within our strategic plan. The first one is around learners, and it very much is what I was just talking about, and it's all about student outcomes and targeting student outcomes. So you've heard a little bit today about age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative, and so one of our targets within this section is what percentage of our students do we intend to have be readers by the end of third grade. And as you have heard, our initiative would have us target 95% as we create a new strategic plan moving into the future. The second one has to do with educators, and it really is about support for teachers and administrators across the state. A really good example is the mentoring dollars that we were able to secure out of the last session, where new teachers and administrators in the state receive mentors in a coordinated way for one of the first times ever in the history of the state, to make sure that those people get the support that they need to be really good at the job that they do and to stay in the profession and continue to make a difference with the way that they go about their work on a daily basis for our kids in the state. The third is around schools and districts. And this really is about support specifically for districts and individual schools. Another example, just trying to give one example on each of these, would be the focus and priority school work that we've been able to do over the past couple of years, where we've identified schools who were struggling to get good outcomes with students. And we've come alongside them in a support role where we've done some coaching. We've helped them develop plans and target different kinds of activities to change their outcomes. And we're seeing really significant gains in those schools. We had 91 schools that we originally targeted and began to support, and nearly 75% of those schools have exited the status that they were in, which would be a level 1 or a level 2 school in the state, and they're now level 3 schools. And I'll come back and talk to you about some of that work and how that's progressing, and our hope would be that we would move even more of those schools out of that status as we work and move forward. The fourth goal is around communities, and it really is working with our partners. We include legislators as our partners, various communities of color, nonprofits, industry in the state, and working with those groups around educational outcomes for kids. And then lastly is the Oregon Department of Education. Really, to do all of that work, we need to be a high-functioning agency. If we're not doing a very good job, we can't do this the way we're supposed to. And so we also needed to look internally and figure out, how do we improve ourselves? How do we make sure that we're giving great customer service, that we're hiring great people and supporting those that we have, and that we become the best Oregon Department of Education that we possibly can be? And so we focused really hard on all five of those goals. We've made good progress. I'd love to show you the stock takes that we do to keep track of all this and how we measure about whether or not we're making progress and on track, so that you can see some of the work that we've had underway over the last couple of years. It's really exciting, and I feel like we're beginning to get some great traction out of it. So customers, we have, you know, we can make this list of customers, and it's sort of this odd list, 197 school districts, 19 ESDs, 1,200 schools, 600,000 students, 70,000 educators, and then the broader community. All those really are our customers, and we focus on each of those, and we have goals set for those and the way that we interact, and we try to measure doing an effective job on delivering to our customers. Our responsibilities, and it says in brief, and so we'll try to do that. And you heard a little bit from Megan Irwin here about the Early Learning Division. You're going to hear from Iris in a minute about the Youth Development Division. Those are two divisions that came to the department on 2 July 1s ago, when out of the last session, the 2013 session. And the partnership has been really interesting and fun, and I feel like we're working in a way that is different than what we had previously. And so I'm going to let them cover those parts. We certainly have an Office of Finance. We send out all of the state school fund to the districts and ESDs across the state out of that department. And they also work internally within the department around budgeting and funding of our various programs. We do academic standards, so things that have to do with the standards for English language arts, math, science, social science, and so forth. We have a significant area where we're working on improving teaching with teacher mentorship, technical assistance, school improvement, analysis of data. We do all kinds of data collection, and we collect that data on multiple fronts, partly to look at how it is that we're doing, and then also to look at our system and how students move through our system to see if there are things that we could identify that would help us think about it in a different and more effective way. And we also send some data on to the federal government, which is part of accountability. We have to be very, very careful with student data to make sure that we keep things secure. And then also we operate the Oregon School for the Deaf. And so those are some big components of some of the work that we do. The major programs that we have, you'll see on this next slide, comprise about 96% of our total budget. And so the State School Fund, obviously, that's a really huge component. Actually, I think that's about 98% of our entire budget. And I'll show you a little bit more about that here in just a second. And then we also have youth corrections and juvenile detention for incarcerated youth. The early intervention and early childhood special education, we know that if we can identify and quickly support students who have learning challenges, that they can overcome those challenges more substantially and have better long-term outcomes. And the sooner and more effectively we're able to do that, the better kind of outcome that we're going to get. And I know that Megan and I work closely on some of those things. And then lastly, state and federal special education programs. And we have a huge duty from the federal government and from the state around special education, and we take that very, very seriously. So I wanted to take a second and talk about budget. I mentioned it for just a minute. $8.97 billion. It's a lot of money. And of that money, where it comes from, you'll see that $6.29 billion of that comes from the state school fund, and then you'll see just over $1.1 billion that come from federal funds, non-limited and regular, and then other federal funds. And then you have lottery revenue, which is about $433 million, and other funds, non-limited, $107 million, and then a couple other small areas where resources come from. So that's where it comes from. How it gets spent is probably also important for us to put out there. And so 78% of this goes to schools, and then there's another grant and aid, which is 18% that goes to schools. Common School Fund, Youth Corrections, and Operations of the Department accounts for about 1.5% of the total. So what funds the Department of Education is about 1.5% of all of that. And the majority of it is funded out to schools. So this next slide took me a 45-minute tutorial to wrap my head around one day, and I don't know that I want to do this too much, but the bottom line is it's a flow chart of federal funds. And so what you'll see is that currently we have an overall budget at the Department of Education of about $154 million. That'd be our operations budget. And of that, $75 million, almost 50%, comes from the federal government. And so this really is a flow chart of what that looks like, where it comes from, and then it comes to the state of Oregon, $1.2 billion, and it goes out to School for the Deaf, corrections, operations, and grant and aid through various offices, and then a lot of it goes out to school districts and to other kinds of providers, districts and ESDs. And so just I want you to really understand how that piece works. And then I want to talk just a second about federal funds within the department, because the federal government doesn't just send us $75 million and say, here, Oregon, use this as you want. They send it and say, here's how we intend for you to use it. And, oh, by the way, Department of Education, you need to monitor it to make sure that it gets used as we intend. And so I talked about $75 million of our budget being these federal funds, and it is because there is an expectation that we would monitor all of these funds that flow through out into school districts and ESDs and to other programs. And so, like, we do significant monitoring of things like our special education in districts across the state to make sure that it's being delivered as intended, or Title I funds for students who exist in poverty. Districts get extra money to support those students, and that we make sure that those funds are used according to federal rule and or guideline or law. And so part of our work is that. If we look at the next slide here. And there are three departments that get the majority of this. And I will tell you that the slide that you have up there is different than the one that's here right now, I think, and it's because what you got was, of the federal funds that we get, how do they get divided up within the department? That's not really what I was interested in. What I was interested in is in the Office of Learning, what percent of their money, and again, this is the part that talks, that works with students and teachers about instruction in the state, basically, how much of what you have is federal. And so you'll see about 52.2% is in the 13-15 biennium, and then and that's in student services, so that's special education. In the Office of Learning, which is around standards and assessment and accountability, it's 32.9%. And in the Early Learning Division, Megan's department, it is, well, this is how it's divided up. It's about 66.1% of funds. So about 66.1% of the funds that are in early learning are federal funds. So I think that's just an important thing for people to know. Structure. You have seen a couple different structure. I'll go back one more. No, forward. I'm sorry.
Rob was a math teacher. He was not. Technology teacher.
It's not there. So let's not worry about it. So I was going to give you a diagram of what our department is structured like, and it's not up there, so I'll give you a brief description. We really have talked about having student learning be at the center of the work that we do, and there are several different components that live within that. One of them is the instructional part of the work that we do, so making sure that our instructional department is all about student learning. And then the next part is equity, so we have an equity division that lives within that Office of Learning. And then our student services, which is special education, and then also our assessment and accountability. Each one of those things is really about student learning, and so we've created this one super department that's very focused on that effort. And then there are some other components, like our information office, so like our chief information officer around technology, it would be like our technology equipment, is a back office function that supports that. Or the deputy superintendent's office is an office that supports that. And so is our finance department is an office that supports that, or human resources department. And so we've really structured a department where these back office functions come around our central work, which is all about student learning. And so within that, the first office around student learning is instruction and standards. And our instruction and standards department, get myself organized here, provides leadership and support around professional development. And you can see a list of things on the bottom of this page, just to give you an example of components of this. Alternative education, accelerated learning, which would be learning around earning of college credit, career technical education, which we sometimes refer to as CTE, charter schools, the Common Core standards, and the next slide, that list continues, and I'm not going to read each and every one of these to you, but I'll touch on a couple. Educator effectiveness, which came out of Senate Bill 290 and was also part of the waiver process from the federal government, which is really about effective educator evaluation for all educators in the state of Oregon. The focus and priority school work that I talked about earlier, instructional materials, statewide support for school improvement, TAG or talented and gifted programs, and then the teacher mentoring grant that I talked about earlier. Office of Learning, this is within the same office, but this is about the equity division. And really, this is a new division at the Department of Education that came to be out of the 2013 session. And it really is about closing the achievement gap for our students of color in the state of Oregon, with a real focus around migrant education, civil rights, and English language learners. And this department has done great work with school districts across the state, and we see the technical support that they're able to give districts in a really challenging area. And we're beginning to see the dial move for districts that have been able to receive that support. Next would be also in the Office of Learning, but Student Services. Student Services is a broader term for special education. And so within that, we do annual federal compliance monitoring. It is important that you know that when we do our compliance monitoring, our effort would be that we're not just going to be a heavy-handed monitoring agent, but that we're going to show up and look at what's required by the federal government, but really be about how is it that we can offer you support to make sure that these programs are delivered as effectively as they possibly can be, and that when we're done with an audit of this, that you're going to say we were helpful, friendly, and you're better than you were than when we arrive, because you have some things to do that you know will make a difference for kids. And so that's a really important mindset for us as we do that monitoring. Dispute resolution is around special education. So that is, if there's a dispute between the districts, parents, or other providers, then we work to resolve that dispute. And then also the child nutrition program is a part of this. And there's more kind of a list if we move forward here. So the Oregon Head Start and Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, the Early Intervention and Early Childhood Special Education Program that I referenced earlier, and again, I'm not going to do all of these, regional programs, long-term care and treatment programs, hospital programs, and then youth corrections. This slide talks about also in the Office of Learning, but has to do with assessment and accountability. And this really is about the creation of assessment and design of assessment and its delivery across the state, and then the reporting that comes from that. There are a number of assessments that we administer, from the science assessment to the English language arts, math. There is a social studies assessment, and then the delivery of that, scoring of it, collection of data and interpretation, and then our use of that, your use of it, the community's use of it, and then reports to the federal government with the need to make sure that we keep all student information secure. Yes, I'm going to move on. I just said that, I think. the Office of Research and Data Analysis. This is the first office that I've reported on that's outside of the Office of Learning. And when I say that it's an office, I should be a little bit careful. It's three people. Brian Reeder is the one that most people would be familiar with who work within the legislature. And Brian really takes a lot of the data that I was just talking about and tries to make sense out of it and understand how it works so that we can look at the kinds of information we're able to glean and make leveraged decisions about how to do the work. He was working very closely with the Oregon Education Investment Board and the longitudinal data system that we're working on. He also works with things like the Quality Education Commission. And one of the really interesting pieces of work that he did recently that I know that you'll all hear about is the work to backtrack outcomes for students who had ever been an ELL student. And it was a really different way to look at the data than we ever have before. And he is an economist by trade. And so he looks at things, Brian Reeder does, looks at things a little differently than some people, like educators by trade. And he was able to identify that when we have students exit ELL prior to the time that they get to high school, that they actually graduate at a higher rate than any other student population or a subpopulation in the state. And so it really makes us think about what happens with ELL students and where they exit and what kind of focus we put on ELL at any point in time in their education continuum, because we know that when we can get them to exit, their outcomes are really strong. That kind of work. The Office of the Deputy Superintendent, well, definitely the least important, I don't know if it's the most or least important office at the department. What I can tell you is that really working on providing leadership for the department, the operations of the department itself, so to operationalize all the work that takes place there and what we do. We staff the State Board of Education, provide Oregon administrative rule writing, and support its adoption at the state board level. Human resources is within the department, and we also work with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes, and there are many other things in the list. 2 more, Office of Information Technology. This would be about any technology that actually exists at the department itself in hard form, whether it's a landline or a cell phone or a desktop computer. But then it also is about all kinds of data collection, the collection that we get from districts, like what's your attendance rate, and then having that and putting it in a system so that we can keep track of that, or your graduation rate, or any other piece of data, and putting that into a usable format and being able to report it out in a usable fashion as well. And then lastly, the Office of Finance Administration is really our financial arm. It's the arm that keeps track of the dollars that we have at the department in order to do our business, the strategic initiatives that we run and that we've been able to run across the state, and then also the state school fund and the resources that go out to schools and ESDs and students across the state. So lots of things, high-level overview. As I said, I'd be happy to answer questions now or anytime. Thank you.
Well, I think we'll hear from Ms. Bell, and then we'll wrap up the ODE with questions.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the director of the Youth Development Council. I'm going to give you a little bit of history and background on the council and how it came to be, and then kind of move you into the work that the council has been doing, and then kind of end with where we are kind of right now. So, oops, and Megan, are you going
to? Thank you.
So the council was established in 2012 in House Bill 4165. Now, Megan had alluded to the old Commission on Children and Families, and so both of our divisions or our councils actually came out of the Commission on Children and Families. And so as we got established, we moved from there, because in that bill, the commission was abolished. We moved into the governor's office for a year in terms of trying to develop and put our ducks in order. And then in 2013, House Bill 3231 came along, and it actually created us as a division in the department. It also did something else. It said to the council, the legislature said, we want you to go out into the community, take some time, and engage community across the state in talking about what the needs of children and youth might be around the state, and then to come back and to create a new investment plan for how to distribute funds to those communities. In the past, the funds had been distributed through a population-based formula, which meant whatever the population of youth were in a particular geographic area, that they had a formula to sort of figure out how much money then that particular part of the state should get. So what we were asked to do by the legislature was to come up with another kind of formula for trying to make investments in community. So we started out and we went across the state. We visited more than 30 communities. We talked and held hundreds of meetings. We talked to all parts of the community. We talked to parents. We talked to community educators. We talked to nonprofit folks. We talked to the business community. And we heard from them on what the needs were. Now, from parents, what we heard over and over again was, were it not for that Boys and Girls Club, were it not for that before school program or that after school program, we don't know what we would do. And this was both in large communities and rural communities across the state. Rural communities really, really needed those kinds of institutions in place to support the families and the young children, particularly before and after school kinds of programs. So we heard that, and we heard that loudly and clearly. And what we did as a result of that was to come up with new data and new information on how we might then begin to distribute the funds that the council was charged with distributing around the around the state. And so what we did was come up with a new strategy. And this strategy was sort of born out of what was happening across the country. The White House had just put out I'm not quite sure what that is. But the White House
had recently... And gods are speaking to us.
The White House had recently put out a report on what it was calling opportunity youth. And these were youth who were basically 16 to 24 who were neither in school nor working. And they talked about the impact of that many young people. We had about 6.4 million young people in this country who are neither in school or working between the ages of 16 and 24. And they talked about the impact that that had, both the social impact and, of course, the financial impact on the economy. And then there were another group of youth that the council took a look at, and those were youth that we were calling priority youth. And these were youth who were indeed in school, but without the proper resources and without the supports in place, they could very easily move on to become opportunity youth. Now, you heard Nancy talk a bit about the barriers to learning and how some young folks can go from that instructional component and go straight through the system, graduate, move on to success. But that is not the case for many, many of our young people in this state. There are barriers that they face. There are barriers that they face in their home lives, in their communities, in socioeconomic areas, and also barriers even in their health and mental health areas. So one of the things that we were charged with doing was kind of taking a look at what kinds of programs and communities existed that could help support these young people, keep them on a positive trajectory towards career or education, and keep them moving forward in a positive direction so that we could help support the goals and objectives of 40-40-20. And so that's what the council set out to do. So part of this had to do with how we would reconnect opportunity youth to education, to career, to workforce, how we would assist in securing connections for young people who were calling priority youth in terms of the things that they sought. And we used a strategy that we took a look at two things. We took a look at need, and we used a needs-based formula as opposed to the old population-based formula. So we began to take a look at what were the needs of young people around the state and how we could assist those young folks. And then we began to take a look at what were some of the equitable things we could do using, again, the opportunity, the equity lens that was developed by the Oregon Education Investment Board, taking a look at how equity really played into how funds were distributed around the state. So, move right along here. Oops, I can't get the paper to move. So what we did as a result of that was to come up with, and what the council did, was to come up with a different kind of way of administering need-based, performance-based grants. And so we came up with a three-tiered approach to what we were calling youth and community. And they began to say, we need to take a look at youth and community and begin to give grants to, again, those community-based organizations, those before and after school programs, those Boys and Girls Clubs, the kinds of supports that young folks need in community to keep them on track. We also came up with and we supported a youth and innovation grant. So what we were also hearing from communities as we went around the state was that they would say things like, if only we had, or if only we could get the connection for the computers for our computer lab, if only we could get a couple more laptops. So we heard from many, many folks that they had their program structures in place, they had the plans in place, they had brought the community together, but what they didn't have was basically that startup capital. They didn't have the kinds of funds that could help them get going in their projects in their communities that they felt were worthwhile and could make a difference in the lives of their young people. And so we established what we're calling a youth and innovation grant. We also went on, one of the things that the governor had done in the last biennium was to put in our budget $1 million to affect and impact some of the gang activities that were happening, and I say this around the state. Mm-hmm. Many folks think that the gang activity is a metropolitan area issue, but there's gang activity happening as far away as Mountaineer County, down in Jackson County, up over in the Basin County areas, in the middle of the state around Central Oregon. So we have gang activity happening around the state, and so we had funds put into the budget to directly impact those particular activities. And then we had a small amount of funds that were our federal funds that we were using to also supplement some of the juvenile crime prevention funds that were in our budget. So that was sort of what we did with that. Now we understood that we didn't have enough money to give funds to every single solitary type of community-based organization that would come our way. And so we required a collective impact methodology to be used in how communities would come together to actually access these funds. And that meant that communities would have to come together and develop a common agenda. They'd have to have a sort of continuous common way in which they were going to communicate what their focus was going to be. They would have to have a common set of outcomes that they would use together. And then they'd have to have some mutual reinforcing activities. So instead of funding individual programs, we funded collective organizations that came together to address a particular issue in the community. And we requested and required of those organizations that they have one backbone organization to serve as the one that would be the intermediary between us and the administrative components that they would need to achieve. And so we set out, and we actually then received about 108 applications that were reviewed by about 30 panelists, and we actually granted awards to 70 organizations across the state. And in doing that, so we also negotiated with them in terms of the performance measurements that they would utilize in terms of the funds that we gave them. So our next round of funding has actually already begun and is underway. This last week, January the 16th, we actually sent out our announcement for our biennial applications that will actually go from 2015 to 2017 biennium. And so we have communities who are, again, looking at what we're requesting and making application to us. One of the things I would say is that in that first round of applications where we had that 108 request, we were able, I think that came out to be about $12 million in requests. We were able to fund about $4 million. So you really understand and see the impact of not having those funds available for these communities. So we were only able to fund a small amount of those communities, and what we're hoping to be able to do, we know we're going to get more communities, because now the word is out that we exist and that we are making investments in communities. And so we've been getting calls from folks saying, we understand we have a program we think will work in our community to help and support our young folks. And so we know we're going to get more requests, and the council is now looking at how they're going to go about managing those requests in this next round. So that's just a quick overview. I think I have one more slide that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of what we send out into the community, what we use internally, and what our FTE looks like, which is very, very small. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions and wrap-ups. Any questions? Representative Puzo.
Sort of one of my pet peeves is the third-grade reading benchmark. I believe it exists, and it's important. But I never hear about what we're going to do with the ones who have yet, who are past third grade, and remediation, all those sorts of things. But we have to fill that gap in order to make the other gap successful. So I appreciate, Isabel, what you said about, but you're jumping to 16. And so I'm just curious what's in place. And, boy, any time we tell somebody they're not successful at something, especially a child, is the most negative message we can send, and they are less likely to succeed. So I really think we need some help with the language we use when we give those presentations as well. But I'm curious I'm hoping something is in place to direct, to address that.
Deputy Superintendent Saxton.
Chair Doherty, Representative Peluso. Wow, that's a really thorny question, I have to say. As a district superintendent, which I did for 12 years, it was one of the biggest challenges that I faced. And it really was, I always felt like we had, that's what I used to say to teachers in the district, that we had a hair on fire emergency from the time that a child arrived at kindergarten until they exited third grade to make sure that they were a reader, and that we needed to pour every resource, every opportunity, and our very smartest way to teach reading as we possibly could from that time to another. And that if we focused on it, we were really good at it, we could get right around 90%. Now, I don't think about it that way anymore. It used to be how I thought about it. And the reason I don't think about it that way anymore is because our system doesn't look like that anymore. It's a really important difference that Nancy and Megan specifically talked about, and that you'll hear us talk a lot about as we move into this session. Because I used to think it was from age 5 to age 8, that was it. It's not very long. Now we think about a system that's birth through 20. We have from date of birth to age 8. It gives us double the amount of time or more to make sure that we're going to ensure that students are readers by the end of third grade. So when you hear us talk about age 3 to grade 3, it's a really important concept about how we connect these two worlds in an effective, seamless way for kids and for providers. And we think that we have a way to get that done. It's the most exciting thing I've ever worked on in my 33 years as an educator in the state. So I just want to make sure that you hear me say that. Yeah. So after third grade, again, I need to talk now a little bit from a district perspective, because when I think about the structures that we have in place at the statewide level and even what we're talking about in this literacy initiative, it really is very much about providing districts with support around the expertise of best practice about how you help students become readers. And just because you're not a reader at the end of third grade doesn't mean that you can't. It just means it's much more difficult, time intensive, and really expensive. And so we have a project in the state right now that we call Response to Intervention. It's a very specific methodology.
He's been trying to get this darn fly up here.
It's a very specific methodology about how we think about ensuring students who are exhibiting learning challenges get the support that they need, especially around reading, but reading and math more specifically. So we've scaled that up across the state. It is one of the strategic initiatives we're asking for now, but we've been doing this. In fact, the district that I led, the Tiger Tualatin School District, is the state provider for this work. And they are in the neighborhood of about 80 districts now that they've provided support on this methodology. Mm-hmm. Again, as a superintendent in a local district, we made a commitment that we were going to focus on reading from the day that they got there till the day that they left and break our, just do everything that we could to make sure that they're going to be readers whenever we could get it done. But the other instructional time that students begin to miss. So I'd like to be in a music class. I need to focus on reading, right? Because if I've got to make a trade about long-term success, reading is really, really important. So it isn't that necessarily has to be. I'm just using an example of something. But there's some other opportunity that they're giving up to work on reading. And then the resource that we pour into it is a low-return investment. But you can't stop. The first 2 years I was in Tiger Tualatin, we had a $103 million budget, and we increased our literacy initiative from grade 9 to grade 12 by $2.2 million because we had to make sure those kids were going to be readers, even when they were in high school, and we implemented a really challenging, difficult, but robust support system for those kids. And it worked for some, but it was really tough work. And individual school districts have to do that work. Mm-hmm. And it is all the way through the system. It's up to us to talk to them about effective systems that can work and try to give them best practice about that. But when it comes to a strategic initiative, an investment that can be recommended by the Oregon Education Investment Board that's going to see a big return on dollars, the best thing that we have is age 3 to grade 3. Mm-hmm. I hope that's not too long of an answer.
Well, I was going to say, we've got about 2 minutes for the rest of questions. Yep. So I'll help Jody or Representative Hack.
We'll talk later.
Okay.
I'll be fine.
Madam Chair, thank you. My question is, how do you plan to continue growing the connections that I know that you're working on with the early learning hubs, our preschools, Head Start, and our relief nurseries? When we talk about 0 to 20 and we talk about age 3 to grade 3, this is broader than just when we've got them in kindergarten. So what are your plans to continue your commitment? I see the great work that you're doing with the hubs and firsthand have seen how that works, but I think it's important that we talk about what are you going to do to grow those connections and how are you going to reach these younger folks before you get them there, because they've got to be ready to learn when they get there.
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, thank you for that question. I think to answer it, one thing I need to point out is that everything that we've done with the early learning system reorganization and transformation over the last 2 years, we did with existing resources. And so the early learning hub network that we've built across the state that's starting to see really interesting connections start to form was done with about $50,000 per hub. And so I've heard a lot from our hub constituents around what they need in order to be successful in forging these connections. The number one resource that they say they need is time. It takes time to build a meaningful connection between early childhood and K-12, let alone between healthcare providers and early childhood and K-12 and all of the things that we've sort of given them as responsibilities. But I think they also do need additional investment if we're going to really support them to make good on the commitments that they've taken on with us at the state level. And so we're looking at how we give them time and space to do that collaborative work. How do we strategically put investment into that system? And then from the division's perspective, how do we support them to be successful at what is really quite a challenging task they've been given? So we see our job at the division when it comes to the hub work and the systems building work that we're doing much less in a compliance monitoring role and much more in a providing support, technical assistance, and any advice that we can pull together at a statewide level that helps good practice that's happening in one community spread.
Thank you.
And I think part of it, just I was last week at the Washington County hubs, and the United Way of Columbia Willamette is working in Washington County, working with kids. All of this is geared towards reading. The Washington County Library System is working with not only the schools but the family resource centers of every school district. And so it was a whole conglomeration of private, nonprofit, libraries, kid, all working together with the idea of having them ready to read. So I was very, very impressed with what they were doing. Any other quick questions? Okay, first of all, I would like to thank all of you. Some of you I've worked with for a while, and some of you I've not worked with at all, but I'm very encouraged with the staff at ODE, and I'm, children are not widgets, and they're sometimes very challenging to work with, but in the end, it's always, you're smiling at the end of the day, and you're going, we just helped one more, and that's a good feeling. So anyway, I appreciate your time. I appreciate the information, and I'm sure you'll be open to meeting with any of the committee members that wish to meet with you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we have no other business, so I'm going to close the informational hearing. Any other business? Okay, I'm going to adjourn the meeting of the House Education Committee. The meeting of the House Education Committee. Okay, I'm going to adjourn.